Okay, so I guess the plan for today is to just have a discussion on ideas, and ideas that could potentially become projects and papers. I had a couple of recommendations, and we looked at a paper on software-defined networks last time, but that's just one possibility, and I want you to tell us what you came up with more broadly, what you have been thinking about lately. It could be anything. It's better if it's related to systems, because that's where I think we have more expertise. If it's something outside systems, then we have to do a lot more background research, and it takes time. Maybe we can start with Daniel and have him say what he has in mind.
Well, one of the things that I was thinking, but I don't have any form of, I don't know if it's feasible, is to try to come up with a distributed system for the network, but using NFS as the enabling to mine.
Okay.
I'm expecting that some configurations or metadata management will need to be synchronized between all the NFS servers.
Mm.
And in the areas where this technology that we were studying last week will come into play.
I see. So, NFS is already, in some sense distributed, right? Meaning that you could have file systems on every host, and you could export file systems using NFS. So, but that's not what, that's not the abstraction you're thinking about. You have maybe a higher level of abstraction.
Yes.
that is built.
All of that in one. I guess file system or namespace.
Hmm. So unifying namespace across all NFS volumes residing on individual hosts, so that individual hosts do not have to mount individual NFS volumes.
Okay.
So they just do one mount. And they basically, it's just like a virtual file system in some sense.
The idea is to get a distributed file system, but using NFS without having to implement all the protocol, the network protocol. But I'm expecting that we will need to synchronize or do some metadata management across all of them, and then is where that technology will come.
So right now NFS doesn't guarantee that, right? Continuous. Changing of one file, it doesn't guarantee any consistency in NFS.
Right now NFS, you have a server and several clients.
Yeah, but let's say one client is modifying a particular file on a server and another client is modifying at the same time. Does NFS provide any consistency guarantee?
Well, if I'm not wrong, they provide consistency on clones of the file.
Clones?
Clones. When they close the file, but the point here is that consistency across servers, because the idea is to mix several servers and provide just a unified namespace.
So there's not going to be any one server. There will be multiple servers.
Mm-hmm. So what are the first question I would ask is, what are the advantages of doing something like this, beyond just mounting, individual NFS volumes at each host?
Well, I could think on architectures where places where you have hundreds of machines, and each of them just have a spare space on their disk because they're using the disk as the local disk of the machine. Let's say you have 100 of those machines and you want to take advantage of the 50 gigs that each one of those has. Right now you would have to use to mount each of them using AutoMount or something and name them by the host name to go specifically to the machine to use that space, and then I guess you will need to keep track of where you put your things on which machine.
In that case it would be the responsibility of individual hosts to know where data resides.
Well, I guess individual person, right? You went to that host to put the data there.
No.
Individual client.
Exactly.
Individual application to know where data resides.
And then you have also problems when you fill up that space and you cannot put something that is bigger than any of the smalls or of the small.
Right. So space is one issue, and I guess I/O bandwidth is another issue. If there is hotspots, then you're kind of stuck with it unless you reconfigure all the NFS volumes and you reconfigure all the hosts, mount points, and everything.
Exactly. So pretty much the solution is already out there, but the idea is to use NFS.
What do you mean solution is out there?
Well, I'm guessing there are some cluster file systems like, I don't remember, Lustre, I think, does that. You configure every of your clients and then they merge their free space in one big namespace. But I just was thinking on using NFS and see how it would work, because maybe we can take advantage of NFS already implemented on pretty much every OS, and we can have implementation OS easy portable implementation across different systems.
Right.
And I guess NFS is also really well tested, so we will have reliability on the network protocol, I guess.
Right. So I guess the idea has value. Okay. I mean, just at a very high level, it should be investigated further. Some of the questions that I would like to answer is what does the software architecture look like? I mean, do you need centralized control of any kind at the software virtualization layer, so that's the first question. Okay, how does the software architecture look like? And the second question is, what kind of consistency semantics can you provide with this virtualization layer? Do you preserve the semantics that NFS provides, or do you somehow invalidate those properties, the close to open consistency, and or do you improve upon the consistency properties, or can you improve upon the consistency properties beyond what NFS provides? Okay, so that's one. So those are two points, and the third point is that how does this contrast with the existing cluster file systems? What are the advantages and disadvantages of going with something like this? I think all three need to be answered. But I think it's certainly worth pursuing. And for instance, something that we could write up for hot storage.
Okay.
Very good. All right. So who wants to go next?
So I have some idea on follow-up with the software-defined networking. So I did some study on the software-defined storage. So one of the things people are talking about in the industry is the software-defined storage and also the software-defined data center itself. So one of the things that they're actually trying to do, one of the key parts of the software-defined storage is passing the user policy to the to the storage end. So basically passing the user, whatever user wants from their applications to the storage, and storage will fulfill the need of the user. So what I'm kind of thinking is how can we design a storage layer which will take the information from the user in terms of its IOPS requirement or latency requirement with some probabilities, like they need like 85% of their IOS needs that IOPS guarantee or latency guarantee, and also some service level agreement number, like metric, the prioritization metric, and transform it in their back end, like figure it out, like how to meet those requirements, basically. And it can be a distributed architecture, like heterogeneous architecture, with a mixture of SAN storage device or some RAID device or a local flash device on the server.
Mm-hmm.
So how you can guarantee that IOPS, and if your IOPS, you cannot guarantee that IOPS to an application, if it's a low priority application, you can decide to go from server flash to the remote storage as well, depending on the priority of the application.
Mm-hmm.
And we can even improve it just because we did some modeling work. So what we can give an application, the application not even have to do in terms of IOPS or latency, they can just say that in terms of application performance. So I can use my model to figure out, okay, what that performance means in terms of IOPS or latency. I mean, what latency range or IOPS range can guarantee that application performance. And we can use the storage device to get that IOPS or latency guarantee.
Mm. So you are, I guess, in some sense, you're describing the process of specifying goals,
mm-hmm.
At the application level, and saying that you have some system that will implement those goals. In other words, I mean, you're kind of defining a specific definition of what you could mean by software-defined storage.
Exactly.
Right. I think that's fine. But for you to take it to the next level, which is convert it into a research project, you need to have some, let's say, mechanisms as to, you know, what kind of mechanisms would actually allow you to fulfill the requirements that are specified at the application level. And second, you need to kind of assume some storage architecture, because if you're assuming some storage architecture to start with, it would be, you know, difficult to talk about the mechanism.
I think what I'm envisioning in a simple way is there will be a remote storage, which is basically an NFS-based backend or some SAN device with a flash on each host.
So you're talking about like a hybrid storage architecture that has both side flash and has centralized network storage.
Centralized network storage.
Right. Okay. Okay. So now you have some architecture in mind. The next thing would be, okay, given certain, first of all, you'll have to justify why these specifications are necessary and sufficient, right? Why IOPS? Why latency? And how exactly? Do you have both IOPS and latency, or is there a correlation between them? And prioritization, you know, what sort of prioritization? Why do we need prioritization? So motivated from the application angle, right? And then once you justify the goals, then you have to talk about, well, what are the new mechanisms that you need to actually implement those goals in an optimal way, so efficiently in terms of resource utilization and correctness of meeting all the goal specifications. So those are the two things that you would need to think more about. I see like a domain at this point based on your description, but I don't see a direction, right? I see a concrete direction that I can go and start implementing. So I think for a research project to reach, you know, a level of maturity where you can talk about, or start thinking about a paper, you need to get to a point where you have all of those three addressed, right? The novelty, the non-triviality, and the utility. right? And before you address those three questions, you need to know exactly what problem you are trying to address that has not been solved before. So, you know, certainly a good direction, but keep thinking as to what exactly the problem is, right, in more specific terms. Why is it a problem? Why is it not trivial and short and all that? Because it's, I mean, another way to look at it is, okay, once you have a problem, you should be able to, you know, create a process or a solution process that has multiple components that takes an input and produces certain output. Like, you have to get to that level.
Okay.
Okay. Anyone wants to go next?
Well, okay. okay, so you're talking about really advanced stuff on OS, but I don't know if this is actually a good idea or not, but I have some experience working with meta heuristics and algorithms, right?
Mm.
And when I was doing my thesis and I was doing research on algorithms to solve my thesis problem was the vehicle routing problem, and these problems are basically they use a lot of CPU time. They are not based on storage or any.
Mm.
They are mostly memory and
mm.
cache and CPU, right? And I didn't find many papers that actually give a relation between the type of use of memory and CPU to the vehicle riding problem. They just give you algorithms and solutions. So I was thinking of maybe designing some kind of use of CPU, like distribute the, like complement the algorithms with distributed systems to solve them more quickly, right? Because right now, there are not really, at least for the vehicle riding problem that I research is the pickup and delivery, and it's supposedly to be the most researched one. And I didn't find many papers that actually distribute the workload of the process time. So since we have already computers with many cores, and we can use clusters and stuff like that to solve problems like ILS.
What is ILS?
It's an algorithm that solves meta heuristics. And basically it's a local search. You
mm-hmm.
try to find, you have a solution, right? You generate a solution for your problem, which is not, it shouldn't be, it's not the best, right? But you then make a little change in the solution to make it a little better. So you have different operators to make the solution better. So you start making it better, or until you find a local maximum, right? Then you distort that solution and change it on a different part of the solution
space.
Mm-hmm. And then you start trying to fix it again until you find a better solution that you want than the one you had found before. So there are many algorithms that you can adapt to distribute systems. So one core finds the best solution, the other one that made another disturbance in the solution, find another local maximum and start, you know, working on parallels. Because when you have solutions sub 500 clients, you have to attend to 500 clients and you want to find the best solution, it takes a really long time, like hours, just to find one, you know, not so good solution.
Mm-hmm.
If you distribute that around a cluster, you may be getting that in a much faster time. And you can add, you know, more complex algorithms that take a little bit more time, but since you're acting on a distributed system, it takes actually a lot less than others, so you can
sure.
compete. And it gives me I really like this kind of problems because you can actually see the application in the you see the application in the real world. You see that there are a lot of, in the United States, they use a lot of algorithms to try to solve this for distributing a flow of bills and stuff like that.
Right.
So, I don't know, it really caught my attention when I was doing research, and I really wanted to look into it, especially that I have, you know, that I can get the knowledge from distributed systems.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if it's a good idea, but, you know.
Well, I mean, it's certainly a good idea, there's no question about it, because you're talking about making sequential algorithms parallel, and that makes a lot of sense now that we, you know, we have a lot of parallel execution engines, lots of cores on machines and lots of machines. So it certainly makes sense to think about it. What I would, you know, investigate more is what has already been done in this space. I think that would be the first question I have, because the algorithm space and the algorithm implementation space has a lot of active research, right? And multi-core, and even before multi-core, you had multi-processors, and people were talking about how to parallelize algorithms for multi-processors. And even before multi-processors, you had multi-systems, which is distributed systems, how to distribute work across multiple machines, right? So there has been work in this space already, from what I understand. So it would be important for you to pursue the literature that already exists. I'm not really, you know, an expert in the algorithms area, but I do know certain venues that you could, you know, conference venues and journals that you can look at to see what they have been up to. But you'll probably have to, you know, the best thing to do would be to talk to some algorithm expert. So you could, for instance, talk to the professor who's teaching the algorithms and get their input, because they'll probably be, you know, at the top of the field, on top of all the research that's going on. They would know exactly where to point you to see what exists already. So I'll be just doing guesswork in pointing you somewhere. So that's what I would recommend. But I mean, certainly the goal is right. I mean, the only question is whether it's novel or not. Like whether people have already looked at it before.
Okay.
And I think that's where you'll have to go next.
Okay.
Anyone else? Leo, do you want to say something?
Sure. I can go next. So, the first idea is, I've been thinking about, and it seems to me that there is potential by making modifications to log sort positions to have more than one entry point for the log.
Mm-hmm.
So, when you have an HSD, you think that this is the array of bytes. So the log sort position, what it does is that it divides this into segments, right? And then at any given point in time, one of these segments is where you have the head of the log, in which you write. Which has a limitation that when you have a string of writes, you always are writing when you have multiple applications writing, the writes have to be serialized, because you have to write sequentially in the log.
Right. Okay, so the device you're assuming here is what kind of device is it?
It's an SSD device.
It's an SSD. Right. A single SSD or an array of SSDs?
Even I think it makes sense even in a single SSD, because they do have, when you write, they write multiple pages in parallel. So, I know I'm talking about the log sort of a system, but actually this, you can use this as the implementation of the fast selection layer, because that was the original idea of the fast selection of the log sort of a system. You can use that as a fast selection layer pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have multiple
multiple entries of the log, or multiple logs, you store the head of multiple logs, then you probably can achieve a very high bandwidth in the SSD.
Right, probably.
Right. I guess we have some disadvantages in the sense that, first of all, it's going to make things more complicated, and then you will probably make the process of cleaning the segments even more difficult because things are more sparse. But if the incremental parallelization justifies the cost of cleaning later on, it's probably something to explore. I don't know. We'll have to run some experiments to quantify if it makes sense or not.
How you select which head of the log to write?
Well, in the log profile system, you start when everything is clean, you start with the first one, and then once the field, you go to the next one, and you keep metadata indicating where is your log.
Okay.
So you have metadata indicating where you have to log. Or three, or whatever you need.
Yeah, but which you pick to write to?
You pick any segment that is clean.
You said that you're dividing the log in several small logs that are available at the same time.
What I'm saying is that it's the same idea in which you have multiple segments, and as opposed to have only one segment with the head of the log, then you have, let's say, two segments, and you have two logs.
Exactly. You have two options to write to.
Yes.
So how do you select to which one to write?
Oh yeah, there has to be some sort of load balancing. It only makes sense when you have multiple writes at the same time. And I think it makes even more sense when you have multiple writes that are very small.
Yeah, I'm asking that because if you write the same piece of data to one log and then a new version of the same piece of data to other logs, then when you clean, you will have sort of problems to get which one is the most updated version.
Yes.
Right. By the way, you guys should ask questions because this is area specific, but this is one good way to learn, you know, some technology. And if you have any questions about what Leo is talking about, you should ask.
Yeah, I don't understand what exactly are you trying to do.
Right. So a disk or a block device is exported as an array of bytes, right? And the job of the file system is to do a mapping between what you call a file and the blocks that actually contain the data for that file, right? There's a mapping between files and that. So there are many ways of doing this mapping, and the way you do the mapping is very important so that when you access your file, you do it in a way that is efficient, and you want to have the blocks together, so you have sequential writes, blocks around the writes, and all those sort of things. There's this file system specifically called the log sort file system.
So the first thing, I guess, you missed is that the file system is the layer that does the translation.
Yes. It does the translation between files and how to manipulate this dump device.
Yeah.
Right? So there's one implementation of file system, in particular it's called log sort file system. And the idea is that it divides this array of bytes in segments. So usually the size of the segment is the size of multiple pages. Page 4K. And then the way it works is that when you start writing, it's going to pick one of these segments, let's say when everything is clean. You get this one and start writing. And you start cleaning on this one. And then once you're done, you pick another one that's clean. The problem is that when you write, let's say here, you write a file. You write to a file. And then you write to a second file. And then you rewrite on the first file again. Then here, when you write again, you write here. You don't write in place. You write to a new location, which means that this space here that belongs to the other file, it's no longer valid. This data is not up to date. Right, so you start having here segments that with data and segments without data. So you see here clearly that there's a fragmentation problem, right? And this keeps happening. At some point, when you're running out of three segments, you have to stop everything and start cleaning the segments. So the way it works is that you read into memory multiple of the segments, you organize everything, and you write the data back into the segment in such a way that you have at least one clean segment. Make sense?
Yeah.
So you can start writing in a clean segment.
Yeah.
And the reason for this is that the is designed specifically for SSDs because SSDs have the property that you cannot write in place, meaning that if you write to a location X, you cannot write into location X. You have to erase before you write. It has to do with some physical characteristics of the medium. So basically you have two operations. You have read operations, write operations, and erase operations. And all of them are more expensive than yours. So you have write that are about an order of magnitude slower than reads, and erase are about an order of magnitude slower than write. So when you erase, you really want to make sure that you don't do it very frequently, or else your performance is going to drop significantly. So with this approach, you always writing, and then when you're running out of space, you have to read everything and clean so you can keep writing. But before you write everything, you have to erase, and that's a very expensive operation. So the goal is to avoid having doing many erases because it's very expensive.
By the way, but SSDs are inherently random. Like, it's not like they're writing sequentially. They could be anywhere in the block.
Yes, but the thing is that at this level of the fast transaction layer, when you issue multiple writes, even if they're at different locations, they have to be serialized.
Yeah.
Because when you have multiple writes, you have to process it and make sure that you're running at the head of the lock always. Even if they go to different logical. When you issue multiple writes, even if they go to different locations in the logical address, those writes are serialized by the head of the lock. Because you always write it here, right?
And what I understood is that you're offering a solution to not do this serialized, right? To do this in parallel.
No. What I'm saying is that you keep the same idea in which you write sequentially, because that gives you better performance. But what I'm saying is that suppose you have only one active segment with a lock, having multiple segments, let's say two. And that way you can issue two writes in parallel, as opposed to one write at a time. Does that make sense?
So it wouldn't really help with the erase problem?
No, it wouldn't help with the erase problem. The erase problem, I don't know what you're calling the erase problem, is that the pattern is very slow?
The fact that you have to erase everything before you get to write.
No, it doesn't solve that problem, and as far as I know, there's no way to solve that problem at the software level because it's a physical problem.
Right.
So you just have to deal with it.
I mean, what I meant was have a more efficient way of erasing.
So you can, I mean, one way is to choose the right segments to erase, and that sort of stuff.
That's what you mean? Maybe the thing.
Yeah. It just sounded like the way it currently picks the erasers at the end is not as efficient as it could be.
No, the way it does it at the moment is as efficient as we know how to do it.
Okay.
The problem is that you have to pick the right segment to erase because data, you have multiple data in your hard disk, and only a subset of the data is highly popular, and the popularity of that set changes over time. So it means that this segment becomes very popular, and then the other one, and the other one. So when you erase, you want to avoid segments that are very popular because most likely you're gonna write it again. That type of thing, that's something that the one that you have to take into account when you pick which segment to erase. Otherwise, the work that you do isn't going to have a very long impact over time. And of course, determining which one is going to be popular, you have to know the future for that. So there's no really way to know.
So on SSDs, are you sure that there is only one head of the lock? Because I will guess that the SSD is parallelized already.
The way I think it works, well, the way I remember it, I think it works is that even though you're serializing the writes here, when you issue commands to the actual physical device, you should write, the writes split in multiple pages to parallelize the write.
Exactly.
And
I guess the space will go to different locks, because if not, it will get serialized again.
At this point, there's no longer locks. It's just you're talking about now the physical device. So when you issue write commands, those are split in multiple pages. Of course, this depends on their size of the write and other things, but
usually the writes come in 4K, right, from the file system. And pages at the SSD at the flash layer are also, you know, in that size, 4K or 2K or something like that. So there's a good mapping of file system pages to flash pages.
But of course there is a log at that level.
Flash translation layer? You're talking about log at the flash translation layer? Yes.
Well,
it would, I shouldn't say yes, because it all depends on, you know, the mapping granularity that that the flash translation layer uses. There is block level mapping, there is page mapping, and then there is hybrid. There is hybrid mapping, where you have you know, a certain blocks, erase blocks that are page level mapped, and then the rest of the SSD is block level mapped. Like block, when I say block, it's a erase block, which is, you know, 2 megabytes or even 64 megabytes, a large chunk of data, as opposed to a sector. Right? So this is a different granularity altogether. So depending on how the mapping is set up, you could, you know, either when you do a write, you may, you know, if it's a block level mapping, you may actually trigger an erase operation on every write.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to write, you know, in a certain area of the SSD, you cannot write anywhere. But if it's page level mapping, then it's completely flexible, that you can take any page and write to any location in the flash. Okay. And in that case, you know, something like sequential writing would make sense, and it would make sense to implement it that way. And the hybrid mapping, again, there is block level mapping, but there's also page level mapping in a smaller area of the SSD. So when you have a write, you first write to blocks that are page level mapped and eventually merge into blocks that are block level mapped. Okay, so even in the page level mapping and hybrid mapping, you know, does this sequentializing that you call, that you describe here. But there is another issue here, which is what Daniel said, and you also mentioned it, that, you know, if you have multiple writes that are sequential, they do not actually go to the same flash chip, because there is striping at the chip level, the page striping at the chip level. So although, you know, you have multiple writes that are all sequential, the device itself could actually parallelize them, because they go to different chips. Now, that is not to say that the effect would be the same as having multiple lock forms. We don't know.
Right,
but it certainly means that, you know, that you have to think carefully about what the benefits you get from having multiple lock points when internally there is already some parallelism going on, right, of a single lock, right? So yeah, I mean, it's certainly something you can think more about, but it would be, you know, it would be very important to think when. And in which situations exactly having multiple lock points would be better than having a single log point which is already struck. And I think that's the really core question here. And to me, it's not clear if there is any real difference there. I mean, in terms of performance. Yes, in terms of, you know, abstraction, there is a difference because you have multiple logs versus single log.
Right.
Is there any, was there any consistency problem with multiple log points?
Mm. You have to kind of know which is the most recent write to a specific log. So you're right. So if you have a sequential log, then you always have the most, you know, it's very easy to figure out what is the most recent write.
Right.
There are multiple logs, it's not clear which is the most recent write of a specific log if it is in two logs. You have to also keep track of some additional metadata to maybe timestamps or versions of some kind that will tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
I have another question, and I don't know if this has already been done, but you're talking about you have issues here when you're having a hotspot, because one of the segments is always, you don't want to erase the or overwrite the information on that sending because it's always used, right? So, and I know you can, you don't know the future, but you know what's happening now, right? So wouldn't it be worth, like, analyzing the system dynamically? Like, if there's a hotspot and you know that, you have some kind of structure that helps you not to, you know, to optimize this
mm-hmm.
at low level, so you don't race all the time.
Yeah, that's. People have been studying that problem for a long time, and it's a combination of what's going on at the moment and what happened in the past as well. They try to establish patterns to be better prepared for what's supposed to be coming next. And yeah, it's a very well researched problem.
Yeah, I think
there's a simple solution.
Yeah, I mean for both. You know, Aldo and Ricardo, it would be good to read some basic papers, like for instance the log structured file system that has a lot of this discussion. I think what I'll do is the storage class, you read a list of papers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good collection of papers for them to read as well, because that gives you a good background of the area in terms of what has already been done. Those are, I would say, you know, a set of classic papers. They're not necessarily the most recent research, but it's good to read them to get an understanding of, you know, what has been done in the past. So I'll send you that list of papers.
I would suggest that we should source that list in a way that, you know, to cover some dependencies.
Hmm.
So I don't think you should start reading. I don't know. I guess you have to cover some basic
knowledge. There were some.
Yeah.
Sort of, there were some.
Some sort of dependencies.
There was a sequence of papers. So because it was structured week by week.
Hmm.
So I put some thought into, you know, making sure that, you know, papers that depend on other papers don't, you know, get switched around. So there was some, you know, but it could probably be made better, right?
Right.
Other good papers will be the ones in the Candius exam. At least the first four that are more broad on an operating system.
Yeah, great. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, I think it would be good to have like a dossier of papers for someone who joins the lab to read.
Someone
they can get started by reading them.
Remember the Unix one should be a good paper to start with.
Right.
Not such a definitely.
Okay, let's do that. I'll create that.
The other is that I haven't thought much about it, but if you're calling about the evaluation, I can throw here and see what people say.
Yeah.
And it has happened to me, I'm sure it has happened to you and whoever has done any set of evaluation. And it's the sense that no matter what documentation you have or your problem to solve, when you're trying to quantify your solution and you have a plan for the evaluation, there are some things that you have to take into account to make sure that you are evaluating your solution in a correct fashion. So the things that you have to take into account changes from problem to problem, because you're trying to solve most likely a different problem. And the techniques that you apply to solve the problem is totally different. But the question is there any set of ground rules that you always have to follow no matter what the problem that you're trying to solve, when you're trying to evaluate, to make sure that the evaluation that you have is correct? It's some sort of evaluation methodology that is as universal as possible. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess what you're trying to say is that when you're trying to compare two things, you want to make the environment as the same as possible, so there is no any other effect affecting the
It's
results.
A subset of the question, but yeah, something like that. For instance, I know that in other research fields, when you do some sort of experimentation, there is a well-established protocol to do that. And the reason for that is because most likely it's very expensive to do that. So they thought very rigorously about how to do what you're doing, because if you messed up, most likely you won't be able to do it again. You think about as an archaeologist, you go spend a week or a month somewhere and trying to find fossils. If you don't follow a protocol to how to do all these things and you messed up, most likely you even ruin the sample or
or you don't have a chance to come back. So the protocol default is very well established. So think about
which field are you talking about?
Archaeology, for instance. But I know that the chemists have the same.
Yeah.
Any science that has some sort of experimental subset, you have some sort of protocol. So in computer science, right? If you're trying some experiments, there have to be some set of ground rules that you have to follow to make sure that you are evaluating your experiments in a way that makes sense. And those rules are not clear to me at all.
I think there are two parts to what you're saying, right? The first part is, well, how to design experiments, and second is how to implement experiments correctly, right? So let's say you have a problem and you have a solution that you build. What comes next? Is there a process that you can follow to come up with the right set of experiments to run?
Right.
Okay, so this is probably harder, but that's also a concern at the moment, right? Now, we always don't run the best possible experiments. After we run our experiments, we realize, oh, wow, you know, we should have run this other experiment. We didn't run that. So is there a way to, you know, is there a process that you can follow so that you can identify the right set of experiments to run, right? And it could be a process that works in reverse, you know, based on, you know, what you want to see and the set of experiments. That's one possibility. But if you have a process to identify the right experiments, I think that itself is valuable. And the second is, once you have the right experiments that you would like to run, how do you ensure that you run the experiments correctly so that, you know, your results are valid and reproducible? Like, someone else can actually read the description and follow the experiments as you did it and get the same results. So those are, I think, two parts to what you're saying.
Right. Just to put an example, imagine that you're doing some sort of work in Scotch, and you're quantifying, you start issuing IOs to your solution, and you start checking throughput, latency, and things like that. But you know, there are some effects on caching, and you have to consider whether you want to do your IOs with OD red or not. And there's all these set of variables that you have to consider. And you know this because you do that very frequently, but sometimes you forget one and then you get solutions that you don't expect or you don't know how to explain because you didn't consider that. So this is just a concrete example, right? Of problems that you basically, the way it works for us is that you run the experiments, you get numbers, you start to explain them, and if you find a logical explanation that makes sense, maybe you do some extra experiments to confirm what you're saying, to confirm your hypothesis. If they don't make any sense, you go and test different things until you get something that satisfies you, basically. But as Ari was mentioning, like, what are the questions that you have to ask when you run an experiment? So that when you start running or designing your experiment and running your experiment, you know exactly what to look for.
I think this is an excellent question. And it's something that people don't think about much, but it's really important. And if someone wrote a paper like that, there will be a lot of people, you know, curious to read it, right? Because it addresses two very significant issues. The first issue, which is, well, how to identify the right experiments, I think it's, if you can crack that, you have a great paper. And the second is, well, how do you make sure that you carry out the experiments correctly? I think even that's a valid, it's a very useful paper for which a professor like me can give to a graduate student and say, just follow this paper when you're doing something. Right? It's a boon for all the, you know, the people who are doing research, because they can just take a paper and just follow it, right? It doesn't get better than that. So yeah, I mean, certainly valuable question to think about, and the answers are not going to be easy, but that doesn't mean that you shouldn't embark on this journey. Certainly valuable.
It seems to me that right now, when we run experiments, basically what we have to do is when you get the results, it's showing the people who have a lot of experience in the field.
And they'll ask questions.
They
start interrogating you. Did you do this or did you do that? Or what happened with this variable? I understand. I mean, for someone who doesn't have all that experience, it can be frustrating because now you have to run like dozens of experiments until, you know, you get something that makes sense.
Right.
Well, wouldn't this have to be different depending on what field you're working
yes.
in computer science?
There would be some general guidelines, but I think a lot of the guidelines would need to be area specific. And so I think you is largely thinking about storage when
yes.
when you describe this, and it would be much easier to write an area specific paper on this, and even that would be really hard, but much easier than writing something that's completely generic. That would be more like a book. I mean, if you want to write something completely generic, that would probably be maybe the first half of the book. The second half of the book would talk about area specific things, right? But it's actually a book, it's not a paper. You could possibly write a paper by focusing on a single area.
I think the complexity about the topics you're mentioning is that, for example, I have read with you guys two papers about storage systems on networks and operating systems in general, right? And what I see is that there are a lot of dependencies. You are designing a whole system, so you have network, you have storage, you have processor time, you have routers, you have a lot of elements you need to combine. So you don't actually have I'll measure this on memory or use of memory and time or something like that, or measure this and on writing time on the storage system or handling files, because when something else fails in the system, like networking, and you're talking about storage, then it all gets messed up. And so there's a correlation between all the elements in the system, right? So it's, I think that the hardest question you have to answer to yourself when you are trying to experiment in this area is, what do you want to measure? What's the most important? What kind of problem are you attacking? Because you have to, an operating system seems to be so complex that you are designing it to solve certain kind of problems. And not all problems are the same, right? So if you have problems that are very, very, they use a lot of storage system, a lot of storage. You have to design an operating system that works on storage, right? That it's efficient storage. So you have to measure your operating system on a storage based performance, not on the other side, because you're trying to optimize the storage, the storage system for the problem, right? So I think you need to give the general idea of what problem are you attacking and how to use, you said, your cost function.
Right. Yeah, I think those are very good points. I mean, this reminds me of a paper that I read. It's called, and I think Daniel read that for a standardized exam, rules of thumb in data engineering. And they came up with rules of thumb that for system design, like, for instance, how do you balance memory and IOs? That sort of stuff, right? How much cache do you need in a system? They came up with rules of thumb based on certain calculations.
Okay.
So I can appreciate, for instance, the rules of thumb in storage system evaluation. And say, here are the things that you need to think about. And some of those rules of thumb could be generic. For instance, one thing that Ricardo just said, which is, okay, you implement a specific solution, but your test environment is a lot more expansive. It has a lot more components, a lot more things going on, right? So you made, let's say, a caching improvement at some cache layer.
But then your workload is sitting, you know, maybe across the network somewhere. There's an OS stack on the other side, and then there is a network in between, and then there is several layers even before the cache shows up on the storage end, let's say. How do you make sure that, you know, you're actually testing the effects of the cache and not some other random effects in somewhere else in the stack, right? So you need to, and, you know, one of the rules of thumb could be make sure that you're actually testing the effect or effect of the change that you made and not some other random effect elsewhere. So question is, well, you want to make sure that is the case, but how do you do that? How do you make sure that, you know, what you're actually testing are effects that you want to test and not some other effects?
You need as a deterministic execution. That is a way.
Yes, even if you have a deterministic execution and let's say you see some difference in results, okay, across two systems, how do you know whether that change is caused because of your modification as opposed to something else happening in the system?
But if it's deterministic, how could it be something else? If you don't change it and you change it back, it should be the same result as before, right?
It would be deterministic, but let's say that your improvement caused some other side effect somewhere else in the system. Okay? That side effect is something that you probably want to avoid. So even though you have a deterministic execution, there are all these side effects that show up. And then, you know, your results are influenced by not just your modification alone, but the side effects caused as a result of your modification. For instance...
So that should count as your modification, right?
The question is, do you want to actually make it count? Should it count? Should your results be influenced only by the modification? Because the side effects may show up only under certain types of workloads. And even if there is a side effect, you should know that there is a side effect. So, and report it. Right? Mm-hmm. The easiest thing is to ensure that there are no side effects. So how do you ensure that there are no side effects? So that you don't have to, you know, pull your hair, try and figure out why your results don't look the way they do. Right? And then, okay, you go through the exercise and you say, oh wow, there is a side effect that I didn't even know existed. Right? So how do you set up experiments so that, you know, you don't have to go through that mess?
But is that what we want, to avoid all the side effects? Or to report that there are side effects, because I guess what is the real case is that there will be side effects.
We don't know what the real case is, right? That's the problem. It's not clear which workload is real and which workload is not. The side effect may show up in some workloads, may not show up in other workloads. This is part of this problem that Leo is hinting at. Which, how do we know that our tests are valid, and for which workloads are they valid, which workloads are they not valid? And those sorts of questions, I think, are really hard. But you can, you know, the easiest thing to do is to say something like, okay, the system works in the following way under these constraints, under these assumptions. And that's really the best you can do, because you cannot reproduce all possible workloads in the world, right? Because there is an infinite number of workloads. And there are infinite number of system configurations as well. So how do you do experiments that are valid, you know, that are that apply to a lot of environments, and at the same time, you know, are focused on the effects that you really want to observe? And if there are side effects that are really important, then you need to be able to identify them easily, that there are certain side effects and what they are, and report on them. I mean, I think these sorts of questions, for instance, rules of thumb would say something like, identify or design experiments such that the core or the key improvement that you made in the system is the only one that makes any difference to the results, right? And then, say, if there are, another rule of thumb could be, if there are significant side effects, then identify those side effects, right? I mean, something like this, that if you can come up with rules of thumb that that cover much more than what we just discussed, I think that would be good.
Yeah.
I read the paper as well. I remember Rules of Community Engineering. Really good paper.
Yeah, it's a really highly cited paper.
Yeah.
Do you think it would be useful that one data center, those data centers that have infrastructure as a service or that provide virtualization, that they provide to researchers, I guess, a clone of, or a subset of the data center where they can put the kernel and let run real-world applications? Because they are already running real-world applications. Just to put a clone and just report them back results and metrics without even reporting what was running. Because I guess the main problem there is that there are workloads that you cannot run and you cannot know about it.
Yeah.
But data centers already run workloads, so.
So you're saying send them your improvement, let them run your workload, let them run the workload and give you back just results which are sanitized.
Do you think that it would be useful without knowing about which workload was running?
It's hard. I mean, that again goes back into reproducibility, right? Now, you can potentially reproduce it by, you know, whoever else contacts the same data center and says, do the same thing that you did for this other guy. Reproducible to some extent, but it's not the most satisfying.
No, I was not thinking on that part. I was thinking on just testing with a real workload.
No, I think that's, yeah.
Because since they already have the real workload, they as well put it to run in the real set and the Yes.
So it's certainly a valid direction. The main challenge here is that data centers and enterprises won't be very enthusiastic about doing that.
Well, but that as a service, I guess.
And a service.
And sell it.
And you sell it.
But to reproduce, I'm assuming that if I understand what you're proposing is that you rent these redundancy machines, and what you asking them to do is, I want you to expose this set of machines to the same workload that this other set of machines was exposed, right? So that my implementation is exposed to a real workload. So to do that, I guess they're going to have to be at least doing some sort of statistical analysis of what's going on in the other machine, to reproduce at least on some high level, to mimic what's going on in your set of machines and put that in place of yours.
Well, I was thinking, I don't know how they run jobs on those data centers, but the same protocol that they follow to run a job in one cluster, do the same on the other one.
So you want to clone the workloads of
exactly.
Other real-world machines that,
since
that sounds like it could raise privacy issues.
No, but that's the thing. That's why you're not doing it. You're letting the data center do it because that is the one that possesses already the workload, and it just reports some metrics without reporting anything about the workload. It's just to ensure that you're testing with a real workload and the results that you're getting is something that could happen. And then in your paper, you say, okay, tested this following the workload file bench. I tested this following real workloads in this data set there between this date and this date. Without even knowing what was there, but you have some metrics and comparisons between the real thing.
Yeah.
It doesn't say much about what was doing, but you already know that
he was doing something.
Was doing something that is real.
Yeah. I agree. I think that certainly is something worth doing. But unfortunately it's not in our area of expertise to set something like that up. It's like a business plan for the data center operators. That we're talking
about. That all the researchers could take advantage of.
Yes.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
To report some kind of result like that.
Absolutely. Yes. So I think we should give Aldo an opportunity to say his piece as well, and what he had in mind.
All I've been thinking about lately, it's not really something that that we could improve upon with software, so it's not really useful, I don't think. But I'm sure you all know that currently, if you run some kind of online business, you're susceptible to distributed denial of service attacks. And the problem with that is that really only really big, powerful corporations like Google or Amazon are safe because they can afford to protect themselves with really expensive hardware. But for someone running a small website or business or whatever, they can be taken down very easily and they won't be able to afford to protect themselves. Even if they purchase some kind of DDoS protection, they might get like maybe 1 gigabit per second protection. That's the most that they can afford, and it won't even be useful because mounting a 10 gigabit per second attack isn't very hard. So there should be a kind of universal way of protecting people without it having to be too expensive. And I think part of the way to do that is to improve on the methods that current systems use to filter DDoS attack data, which I guess would be a kind of software layer type of thing, but I'm not really sure how they work. And also the hardware is very expensive. Like, for example, a single node that protects only 3 gigabit per second costs, that piece of hardware costs like $10,000.
Hmm.
So I'm not really sure where to go with that.
So I'm just curious, if your enterprise business is hosted on some data center, wouldn't the data center have
the data centers that provide DDoS protection, they won't hook you up to the protected node unless you pay for it.
Yeah.
So they'll just leave you open to anything, and if you present a problem, they'll know about your IP, and that's it. You know, until the DDoS stops, and then you'll go back online, and then you'll get DDoS again, and then eventually they'll just kick you out of the network. And this has happened to me actually. It's very annoying. As a matter of fact, I'm paying right now $200, and all I have is 1 gigabit per second protection. $200 a month, and that's with a 50% lifetime discount coupon that I found. So it's very expensive, and it's very annoying.
Yeah. I mean, the DDoS attacks are kind of weird because, I mean, I'm not really sure what the attackers actually gain from that.
They might just be bored, or they just don't like you and they just want to take you down. Even if it's only for a little while.
Well, they stop their business, right?
They stop, but they don't get, I mean, oh, maybe it's a competitor. Okay, so a competitor could launch DDoS attack.
Or if they just don't, let's say you ban someone from your website, and now they're mad at you, and they just DDoS you, and say, okay, screw this guy.
Is that what happened to
you? It could be, I don't know.
So in other words, don't kick anyone out of your...
But if they break the rules, yeah.
Especially those who can launch DDoS attacks.
How do you know that they can launch DDoS attacks? It's not something you can readily defend yourself against unless you have all these mountains of dollars that you can just, all right, here, you know.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, this is a challenge, and I mean, starting any business is not easy. You have all kinds of challenges.
Right. So I run a game server, and it used to be where I would have 200 concurrent users online. But due to these DDoS attacks that I've been getting, I have protection that helps, but it still causes tremendous lag on the actual game service and disconnects and whatever, and a whole bunch of people have been quitting because of it. Now, the most I've seen in the previous couple of months concurrently is 90, with an average of 50 to 60 people online. So that's a significant drop. It's not good.
And you need to work on your people skills.
It's not really, it's not even about that.
Well, how can you work on people's skills online?
Well, it was the consequence of him kicking somebody out or mistreating somebody else.
But it's not even that. It's, okay, you have someone that breaks the rule and you say, well, you know, let's say he abused a glitch or a bug in the system that deserves a ban. We're not just going to say, oh, well, it's okay, do it and keep doing it, you know, because I don't want to ban you. I have to ban him.
But first of all, how do you find out that someone is abusing a bug?
Well, let's say that all of a sudden, tomorrow, something...
He has like 10,000 points or racked up...
Right, exactly. Like, he suddenly went from being someone with moderate wealth to the richest player in the game. That, you know, there's probably something you investigate and say, okay, look, this is... Look at the trade logs, look at the system. He hasn't been fighting any monsters. he hasn't been fighting people. He just randomly got this. Okay, there's probably a problem here.
I mean, isn't the right thing, in a way, he has to find a bug, right?
Well, not necessarily, because I know there's a bug, but how do you do it? I can't fix it unless I know how to do it.
Oh, you can't fix it. Okay.
So they're never going to tell you how they did it.
Uh-huh.
And you have to hope that someone finds out and then tells you. So that's also a problem.
I see. Okay. Yeah. I mean, so they sort of pointed the bug out to you.
Now I know there's a bug.
And you know there's a bug. And you know that potentially other people
Although it
could
does help me
it.
Track it, so it would be easier to find people that abuse it and ban them as well,
right.
Which creates a cycle.
So it's interesting discussion. I think, a solution for something like this is already done, but the thing is that they're not affordable. And that's your
right,
point.
So the problem is that they're not affordable.
They're not affordable. So what can you do? I really don't know.
Yeah, that's why I did that.
So how does it work? Basically, you have to have at least an IPs from which you're just going to drop the request, right?
Well, yeah, if I get a connection from okay, there are three levels of bans. There's the ban, the regular ban. So if you try to log into this character, it won't let you log in. That character.
No, I'm thinking
banned.
About the partition mechanism itself.
Oh, I'm not entirely sure how it works, but there's kind of like, it's similar to a router or a switch that takes the data and then filters the requests to send clean data to your server and then drops any data that's not or any requests that are.
Some blacklisted IPs.
Malware, and it uses patterns to detect what kind of attacks are or what kind of traffic is clean and what kind of traffic isn't. So, I guess there's a certain pattern that attacks follow that regular users don't. So, if you match this kind of pattern, you'll be denied, and if you don't, then you'll be allowed to continue. And it's not perfect. There's always a chance of a false negatives false positive. And sometimes regular users do get blocked, and at that point you would contact the data center, and they would, like, all right, let's try to modify the rules a little bit.
Right. Yeah. Unfortunately, this is not in in the realm of things that we do in the lab. And we used to do security a little bit earlier, and I know that there's lots of solutions out there for distributed denial of service. Pattern matching and IP blacklisting and that sort of stuff. What you really want is maybe like a homebrew solution to the problem that is affordable for you.
And I guess the cost is drive by computational firmware filter.
Yeah.
You need specialized hardware to do that.
Right,
as much as you receive more attacks, you need more firmware.
That's what makes it really expensive. But if there could be something that's affordable, whoever came up with it could potentially make a lot of money too.
Right.
It would redefine the business.
Mm-hmm. Ideally, you want to run that, it to be a software and run it inside your virtual machine, and that's the best solution than to have to set up more hardware and so on. Okay. All right. So, what are the other thoughts here and ideas? What other ideas do you guys have? Anything else along software-defined storage? So, one of the things that I want you to think, Leo, is with the right caching work. How can you make it completely distributed?
It's really in what sense?
In the sense that, if you don't have centralized network storage, or even if you do, how can you access the cache of peer nodes, peer hosts, right? Can you create a distributed storage system that where your cache management policies are software defined? In some sense.
Actually, I have to go. I have an exam today.
All right. Here, I'll
go. I don't think I understand.
Right. So what I mean is, okay, let's say you have caches, you know, host side caches at all your hosts, right? And they're all doing something. If they are working independently, they would provide benefits to the applications that are running on those specific hosts. So a host helps applications running on that host.
Right.
Right. But these SSD caches are actually, pretty powerful. They're expensive, so it makes sense for you to share them up over the network.
So right? You want to share the SSD cache with our peers?
Possibly. Yeah, let's say there are hotspots. There are some hosts that require a lot more caching than other hosts. Right. Instead of a host missing the cache and bombarding the storage, if they can potentially utilize the cache or spare cache available on a peer, they could do much better, right? So the question is, well, how do you orchestrate this? How do you coordinate all this? And potentially you could think of a software layer that keeps track of the cache requirements at various hosts and sends commands to the individual caches to say, okay, here's a cache that you could potentially use besides your own local cache, right? That sort of stuff.
The downside that I see with the approach is that since data centers are designed in a way that there's a hierarchical, a tree-like structure in the network, then sharing your cache with someone in the same rack might be efficient, but the other rack might not. So to make it efficient, you have to have knowledge about the topology of the data center.
Yeah, it certainly would help to know the topology of the data center. Absolutely. Yeah, but the question is this beneficial in any way? I mean, do you see that workloads, well, of course, there is another possibility that you do load balancing at the workload level. Say, okay, this the set of workloads or the workload that's run on a specific host is overwhelming the cache on the host. So let me split the workload into two and run a piece of it on a different host where the cache won't be overwhelmed. You could solve the same problem at various levels of granularity. But even for that second solution, you need to know what the cache state is, right? And so we could think of, people are doing software-defined networks. You could think of managing the software, the storage layer, independently of the application layer, which is, redirecting workloads across hosts, right? So certainly something I think is a possibility for software-defined storage. And another, what you talked about also falls along the lines of software-defined storage. I guess you need to think about what the controls are, and is it something, is there a software-defined layer that administrators can configure to do your distributed NFS?
I was thinking now on the LogFS problem. I remember this paper that they talk about separating
head and tail.
Head and tail, so you do.
That's a FAST paper now. It's a new paper in FAST 13. They have a paper.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What do they solve?
What they basically do is that when you have striped writes
mm-hmm.
across multiple disk heads, then your writes go to all disks, and then your reads also. And so write performance suffers because you have all disks need to serve reads as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what they say is that make the writes go to only one disk,
mm-hmm.
so that write performance is improved, and reads are sort of focused on the rest of the disks in the array. So reads don't interfere with writes. That's basically what they do.
And they do garbage collection on only the other one. Because writes get no interference with the garbage collection.
Right. So at any given time, you're writing only to one disk. And then when you fill up that disk, you move on to the next disk and write only to that disk and so on. So that's what they do. So chained, that they call it chained logging.
That's the work that they propose to do, some sort of Rails SSDs, right?
Yes.
But I remember that they...
Not with SSDs,
no.
But disk drives.
Disk drives and a huge log effect across.
Disk drives is where they, you know, the random reads and writes will cause significant issues.
But it seemed they did garbage collection on the not active disk.
Yes. Yes, that was part of the key to... So that
yeah.
Your write performance doesn't drop.
Yes, that's true.
Okay. So you could have that mixed with your idea if it makes sense to have more than one active head and other passive disks. And by head, I mean disks. And have them distributed and then control it if it's necessary with a layer of
if you think about it, if you have,
software
let's
defined.
Say you have a huge amount of disks. Then imagine another reason we should have the number of active disks, number of heads, increases the shrink depending on the workload.
Hmm.
And have passive disks and do garbage collection on them and use on those and use LFS as
right.
As your file system.
By the way, did you can you guys access the FAST 2013 papers now?
I haven't tried, but.
Yeah, you can. So read that paper because they may have some of these ideas in there because I think in the original paper, which was in hot storage, they did mention something about having multiple logging heads.
Mm.
So, and in this paper, they expand on it into a complete work. They may have more details.
Okay.
So it'll be something to look at.
Yeah, but...
So this distributed caching idea, is this something that that you guys think is worth exploring? So where you have local host-side SSD caches, and you have workloads that use these caches at different ways, different degrees, two different degrees, and so that some caches are less utilized than others.
So it's a distributed cache.
Yeah, it's sort of a distributed cache. So there is, you need to think about issues of consistency, and we sort of addressed that to some extent in the Write Policies paper. Question is, well, how does it apply when you have a distributed cache?
And in that distributed cache, you will have copies in different parts of the cache, or just one active copy everywhere?
You could think about, right, those are the questions that we would need to think about now.
But having to go through the network, wouldn't that increase the latency?
You would. So, but what is the alternative? What is the alternative?
Going
to the network, perhaps farther away, and accessing a disk instead of an SSD, right? So that's the alternative. And also increasing the load on the shared network storage. So that's one version of the problem. The other version of the problem is, okay, you have completely distributed storage, no centralized storage at all, right? And then how do you create a unified, let's say, block store on top of this completely distributed storage? And each node could have, let's say, you know, an SSD and a disk drive. This is the problem that some startup companies are looking at. For instance, this company called Nutanix. And
just
looking at this problem.
So instead of using the SSD to cache the things that the host is, that the client is accessing, they will cache the things that the server is exporting.
Right.
So pretty much they will cache what they got.
So are you talking about what Nutanix does?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what Nutanix does is, you know, every host is a client as well as server.
Okay.
So and data moves to where it is accessed.
Isn't that the Google model too?
Google model is very similar. So, it's slightly different because they actually talk about moving computation to storage, to where the data is. But here it's somewhat different in the sense that data moves to computation. So in the MapReduce model, you create a whole bunch of tasks and you dispatch them, and you want to dispatch the tasks close to where the data that they access resides, right? Here you have...
What they move is the cache of the real data. They don't move the...
In the MapReduce model?
No, in this new model.
In this new model, yeah, they basically cache the data locally and access it locally. I'm not sure if they move the primary copy as well. I think they just make a copy and cache it, use it temporarily, and maybe discard it after.
But that cache is distributed.
That cache is distributed.
I don't understand why you prefer to move that as opposed to computation. It seems to me that it's cheaper to move the computation.
Sometimes you, it's not easy because of IP issues, right? I mean, so if you have, and also, let's say you have an application.
Okay.
You have an application that you're running. It's on a single host, let's say, that to make things very simple, and you have other applications running on other hosts, right? Now, that you have some shared distributed storage that's shared by all of these applications.
Mm-hmm.
Different applications have different intensity, different workloads at different times. And let's say you have local SSD cache. Now you want the data for the application that's running on a host, and you could have multiple applications running on the same host, because if you have, let's say, 64 cores, you have hundreds of VMs that are running on a host, right? And each VM is an application. Then you want to kind of make the best use of the SSD and the best use of the distributed storage resources. So all your data is distributed across all the disk drives. And data that's accessed by a specific VM may not be available locally, and it may not be cached in the SSD cache. So you need to move some data around to have the application being able to access the data. Now, of course, you could say, well, let's migrate the VM to where the data is. But if the data itself is distributed across all the disk drives, then you don't have a very convenient location to host the VM in. But once you figure out where you put the VM, let's say at some host, then you have a cache that's available at the host that you could potentially use, right, to pull in all the data from all the different disk drives that the application needs, cache it temporarily in the SSD, make the VM use the data, and then once it's done, throw it away. And that's sort of the idea. And not throw it away, but maybe flush the cache to the persistent locations. There is no single location of the data. Because you want the full bandwidth of all the disk drives to be available to each application. So you want to sort of distribute the data. Otherwise, you might be creating disk-level hotspots.
So the idea is to have the data, to move the data around automatically based on how frequently you use it.
Right. Exactly.
And if it becomes a hotspot for multiple hosts, you create multiple instances of the same data?
What do you mean? If multiple hosts share the same data?
I'm thinking of a model like this. Suppose that for convenience you do have a remote shared storage, and then each host maybe have an SSD.
Mm-hmm.
I know, let's throw a big hard disk too.
Mm-hmm.
And this is unique to this unit, and then they also have access to the remote network.
Yeah.
And the data, I guess you can think of it as some units that could
be virtual disk.
Here or here or here.
Mm.
But if this data in particular becomes active or popular in this host and this host, because you have to agree with the publisher.
Yeah, but the question is, what is the granularity of that data?
Right.
That, is it a virtual disk? And if it's a virtual disk, then typically...
No, I'm thinking of these in the size of, I don't know, some sort of block or
something. Lots. Okay. So then there are consistency issues,
yeah.
Right? So that you need to address when multiple hosts access the same file. The question is, does that get addressed at the block layer, if you want to build a block layer solution, or does it get handled at some cluster file system layer? I think it gets handled at a cluster file system layer that spans across all of these hosts. File system is the one that manages consistency for access to files.
And this is a model similar to the one in self-storage.
Yeah, where there is no file system, but you just have blobs being stored.
Right, but I think, you potentially could build a file system above that.
Yeah, you could build a file system on top of the blob store. So that's one idea which I think can be written up for hot storage, which is, how do you do a distributed caching solution using SSDs, and that's sort of based on the idea of software-defined caching. Software-defined distributed cache. Because one of the key questions there is, how do we know whether the cache is being underutilized or overutilized? And how do we, allocate caches in, to a specific host in other hosts? So this is, similar to distributed memory sharing work. So it would be important to look at that work to see what they do. And they don't really talk about software-defined memory sharing. So that would be sort of the new idea here. Well, how do we make this centrally controlled layer of intelligence that figures out what each host needs and how it does a reallocation or sharing of cache. So a host may get a little bit of cache from host 1, may get a little bit of cache from host 2, and a little bit from host 3, and a little bit from host 4. Right? So something like that may also be possible.
And you have to see some sort of cost to write to this?
Right.
But
yeah.
The association will be on the host granularity or not, or on the application granularity. Application host 1 will allocate in these different caches, or it will be the complete host that has some load,
mm-hmm.
and it requires certain capacity of
caches. That's a good question. I think the cache would need to be managed as let's assume that these hosts are all virtualized, right, at the hypervisor level. And because the hypervisor is the one that manages storage, right? And now the question is, does the hypervisor export this portions of this cache to individual virtual machines and let them directly access the cache or not? It's certainly possible.
So there's only one piece that inches of the SSD then?
In each host.
Are you thinking about virtual host? Or a physical host?
Okay. One SSD per physical host.
One SSD per physical host, and that SSD, that host, it's hosting multiple VMs.
Yes.
And you export some portion of the SSD to each VM.
You could. I'm not saying that you should, but that's one possibility. Another possibility is that the cache is completely hidden from the VMs. The VMs don't know there is a cache. If they, otherwise now the VMs would need to manage the cache themselves, right?
then the problem is sort of shifted to the VM level. I think at the first...
So what are you saying is that the solution will be in the hypervisor, so then you don't need to worry about...
That's the easier solution, I think. I think that's the easier solution. I'm not saying that's the better solution.
So this hypervisor has certain load, and it requires more cache that it already has, so it needs to request cache from the other hypervisor.
Exactly. So the question is, how do you determine if the load of hypervisor 1, caching load of hypervisor 1, is more than caching load of hypervisor 2? I think that's the sort of the hard questions here, more specific questions. And then, you know, how do you sort of rank and determine the amount of cache that individual hypervisors need, and how do you redistribute the total cache resources in the network across all these hypervisors?
And we will aim into a flat architecture where everyone should be the same.
Latency?
Yes. Because
you mean
not
like
that
a class network? Yeah, you could go with that assumption, but that's a very special case assumption which doesn't apply to most data centers today. But we could, you know, go with more conventional hierarchical networks and say that there is rack level cache locality and then, you know, hierarchies, node level cache locality, rack level cache locality, and that sort of stuff. Maybe some switch levels.
But that is not related to this problem that I think Mario was working, bin packing problem. You will have certain loads and you need to put it in certain bins, will be the SSD cache.
That's the algorithmic aspect of this.
That problem is so generic that you can apply it almost anywhere.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, that might, that would be a logical direction to go from the algorithmic standpoint to determine what gets packed and how it gets packed.
But I think of it more like a dynamic partition cache problem.
Yeah.
Like at some point you have to, like that, you have an SSD and you have different segments of the SSD for each bin, and then you have to more dynamically.
Yeah, that's right.
Does it make sense?
Yes, it does. So you have like, periodic re-evaluation of what the workload looks like and periodic reassignment of partition sizes.
Right.
But that's a smaller granularity. That's on one SSD to partition the SSD across the VM of that host.
Yes.
No, I was thinking of this as being the total cache across, it's combined across all the SSDs.
But then,
and then you need to sort of figure out, you know, how much to allocate to hypervisor 1, how much to allocate to hypervisor 2, and so on. And then once you know that, then you need to figure out, well, how do I get this? You know, how to map this to physical SSDs, this sort of the virtual data.
We have to have the unique view per host of this distributed thing, because there's cost associated with writing with it. Like I think when you're...
So that's a software-defined layer, right? So
yes.
At the, let's say, the configuration layer, you do all of these calculations, and then once you know how to do the mapping of this virtual SSD cache space, the physical SSD cache space, then you send out commands to individual caches. Okay. You can use your cache or a portion of your cache, and that's it. Or you can say you can use your cache plus a piece of the cache sitting on host X and host Y.
And what would be the protocol for that?
That's something that we would have to define.
It seems to me that we can use iSCSI.
You could use iSCSI, you could use IP. I mean, that for propagating those commands, you could just use a TCP connection.
Because that seems...
That's just a command.
Sort of related of my idea, where you had several NFS hosts and then you need to... First I'm putting all available to everyone, but you could also have these hosts supporting to this machine and then changing to support to the other one. So similar, but it's not the same technology. And if you have NFS, you change it for something low level, like iSCSI or...
Yeah. Yeah, I think we should explore, we could explore both directions. And write, let's say, two separate papers with two different perspectives.
I think me was working in a similar thread.
Like this one? SSD distributed cache sharing?
I don't know if it's a distributed part. I know that Ducardo has been working on SSD
caching
for
Ming is working on a similar thread because in the Avanza class that I took, one of his students was working on that problem.
Okay.
And I remember that they used IS Coastal. It was basically a hack because there was no, they didn't solve any consistency issues or anything like that. But
no, here I'm talking about software-defined cache management, right?
Well, exactly what they were doing, as I remember, is that you have multiple SSDs and hosts that you share over the network.
Hmm.
So the idea was not as mature as thinking of a dynamic arrangement of the data moving from one bit to another. It was just you have multiple hosts, SSDs, and the SSDs are shared across multiple hosts. Oh no. Now I remember, yes. The sharing was to address consistency issues. As opposed to address the consistency issue based by implementing the right policy, it was done by having multiple copies of the data, something like that. Yeah. It was to address the consistency issue. It was not, that was the main goal.
Mm-hmm. I see. Right. So I'm kind of interested in exploring this idea further and possibly sending something to Hot Stories. So if any of you guys want to take the lead on it, then we can meet and discuss more. And I'm also interested in taking the distributed NFS idea further. And it seems like you are interested in thinking more about that, right?
Maybe.
So yeah. We could meet for that as well and submit something to Hot Storage. So let me see when Hot Storage takes papers. We just need to write a 5-page paper. It's a position paper. It's not that difficult. And it doesn't have to have, full evaluation. Hot Storage, the way I see Hot Storage papers is that there is an idea, you justify the idea, right? To some extent, and the key element of a successful hot storage paper is the idea has to be completely unconventional, right? And new, and it has to have real impact, okay? With the potential for real impact. I think it's once you have a hot storage paper, it's very likely that, you'll have a fast paper after a year or so, or maybe even the same year, depending on how fast work goes. So submissions are due on March 11th. And then we'll hear back on April 15th.
Okay.
So think about this and write to let me know. There is another idea that I was thinking of exploring for hot storage, and this is along the lines of what we discussed when I was sending the soft VM proposal. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
For non-volatile memory.
Persistent memory.
Mm-hmm. Non-volatile persistent memory. So, basically talking about that approach. And what happens if you have non-volatile memory that is byte addressable? And what kind of abstractions, programming abstractions, can you think of building on top of such devices? And I was thinking that SoftVM is a likely candidate. We also have a proposal that we could possibly, build upon and send something to Hot Storage. So that's some of the possibilities.
Yeah, the proposal had a very good form already.
Yeah, yeah.
It was well defined, or at least very good defined.
Yeah, it was well defined, and it just need, you know, some of the ideas might need a little bit of fleshing out. It should be, you know, it should be submitted. So think about it, and so send me an email as to what, you know, what you want to do for hot storage.
In this byte addressable persistent memory, is NVRAM, what's the most relevant work that has been done about it?
PCM, phase change memory.
Not in terms of technology, but in terms of what has been published so far.
Oh, okay.
There's been
quite a bit. But if I send you the proposal, there is a comparison to all the related work that exists for NVM so far. And so it's, the proposal is a good start for reading that. There's work from UC San Diego, and then there is work from University of Wisconsin-Madison. There is some work from Princeton as well.
I think we have some of those references in the Safian paper too, right?
Yeah.
Just can't remember the name of the other work.
Okay, so there is one work called Moneta or something like that, and then there is Nemosign, then there is SSD Analog. I mean, these are all different papers that talk about NVM. Some of them don't really talk about NVM, they talk about SSDs, but they have similar abstractions. The proposal has more details.
People are fishing and working on that.
Yes. On NVM, right? Yeah, I think that's certainly an area of high interest. A lot of people are spending time and money thinking about non-volatile memory. It's not clear what will happen in the future, but certainly seems like people don't want to miss the boat if something happens. Right? I think that's the key. And in some sense, it's also strategy, right? Because if let's say a press guy comes and asks Fusion, you know, we've heard that there is this new PCM technology, are you guys even doing anything about it? Then Fusion shouldn't say, oh, no, we are not doing anything about it, right? It's not good for their own image. They need to say, okay, they are doing something about it. They have something, but it's hush hush, we won't talk to you about it.
Yeah. They do have a couple of people who have a very good understanding of how SSD works.
Yeah.
People who are physicists.
Yeah. So what do you guys want to do? Daniel, what is your initial thoughts? You can certainly think more about it, but I want to hear what you want to do for hot storage.
Right now, I wouldn't have a clear preference.
So you want some more time to think about it?
Yeah, I would think of the three things that we have in the... if you think the distributed cache, the distributed NFS, and the non-volatile memory. So.
And how about you, Leo?
I would prefer the number of
non-volatile memory.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right.
So networking. I hate networking.
That is true, yeah. Okay, so then, I think you get to lead the non-volatile memory work then. Okay. So what I'll do is I'll send you the proposal, read through the description of hot storage, the call for papers, and maybe you can come up with, say, an initial plan for what should go into the paper based on the proposal. Do you have a copy of the proposal already?
No, the hot storage copy paper.
Yeah. just read through that and see how the proposal could be refashioned into a paper. So Daniel, I guess you're stuck with two others, the distributed caching and software-defined caching and distributed NFS. So think about these two, and I mean, certainly you can be involved in the other paper as well, and same goes for you as well. But I want one person to take the lead on the paper in terms of making sure that the writing makes progress. I think the key for the hot storage paper is that the writing has to be really solid. And you don't have to have a lot of experiments. One or two basic experiments are sufficient. And for the NVM, we can simulate it using DRAM itself. So Daniel, you let me know via email which way you want to go, either the distributed NFS or distributed caching.
Okay.
And if you want to do the distributed caching, I would highly recommend that you first read the Write Policies paper that Ricardo and Leonardo wrote, because I think some of that would be valid. And the other paper that I want to point you to is a paper that we just submitted to ATC, Ricardo's cache partitioning paper, SSD cache partitioning. So that's also related. And when you read these two papers, you might get some more concrete direction about the SSD distributed caching.
Is it the one related to the wastage cache?
Yes, exactly.
That's a really good problem.
Yeah. I mean, we've been kind of on the border multiple times with this paper. Almost in, but not really. Like for fast, we missed by just one point, one score. And otherwise, we would be in.
But I think the paper, unlike the others, we have the possibility to apply a lot of theoretical approach to it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, if it's something that you care about, it's really good because...
Yeah. Yeah, I think you would find it interesting as well, because there is the approach uses dynamic partitioning and some algorithmic techniques. No, the paper that we just sent to USENIX, I'll forward it to you.
Okay.
Send me a copy to
you. Okay, I'll send you a copy and Ricardo, and also you can access the Write Policies paper from the FAST website. Okay? All right, guys.